This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Yeah, welcome to the Christian War Room, and this is possibly the not the last, but the last in the rundown of our 100 years of trend analysis. You know, what has been happening in each decade, and we always need to bear in mind that people are shaped most likely through the decade they lived through in their youth. So when you look at somebody's life and you look at their, you know, their formative age, maybe when they were 12, 13, 14 years old until they were 24, and when you look at that decade and what goes on in that decade and what is sort of the spirit of the age, you know, the stuff that was important to them. And if you look at that little gap, you can pretty much get a good idea of what this person is all about. And so you find that there's a very different mindset from one decade to the next decade. And you can see this sometimes very easily. When I sort of go back, I had one granddad. He was born in 1890. And he had sort of, he was born in Prussia. And he had a very Prussian mentality, you know, of doing this sense of duty, being duty bound, and a sense of order. A way things have to be, and just one way, no other way. You know, the government is in control, and you need to respect the government. And there's a certain sense of morality was there as well, of doing right and wrong, which was very much dictated by, you know, the typical mentality people had in the Prussian Empire in the early 1900s. So that would have been the time of the First World War, maybe shortly the time after the First World War. It's very, very interesting. And then when you sort of go through and you look at different generations, they're all sort of slightly different. They've got a different bias, a different value system, and a different outlook on life, slightly different outlook on life. And for us, it's very, very important to sort of, as Christians, to understand what is going on so that you can effectively communicate with people from different decades and from different backgrounds and from different outlooks on life, to let them understand the gospel. In the end, it is not important to persuade them, but it's important to relate to them, or relate to them, number one, you know, so that we can communicate with them on their level. And we are the guys with the message, not they are the ones who are asking for it. We are the ones with the message. So we need to adjust our delivery to a manner and to a way that these guys can understand this. And when I'm saying all this stuff, the accusation can be put forward and to say that this is about watering down the gospel. You know, the gospel is a gospel, you cannot change it. But I would contest, and I would say you need to speak to a person in a language the person can understand. So if I take my King James Bible, yeah, and I start quoting scriptures from an English that was in common use in 1611, and I'm speaking to somebody in 2018, and the language has changed, the vocabulary has changed, I'm not doing a very good job. Even though I'm a big friend of the King James Bible and what it stands for and what it achieved, I would not go that far to require a potential newcomer to the faith, to Christianity, to force him to learn a second language like English of 1611, in order to read the Bible and then to understand it in his own terms. You can do it, and it does work, but it takes a long time for people to sort of retune their reading skills and their understanding, and to learn new words which have no longer been in use in the vernacular for maybe hundreds of years. So it's important for us to adjust our delivery and to speak to people in a way they can understand. And to be able to do this, we need to find out what makes them tick. And to find out what makes them tick, we need to listen to people very carefully to find out, you know, what are they all about. So if you talk to somebody, don't just sort of overwhelm them with words, but allow yourself some time, if you've got the time, and listen to what they have to say, you know, and what the problem is. And it's more important, though, if the person you're talking to is older than you, because very often their life experiences are much more richer than yours by default. But also as a sign of respect. Yeah. And then, you know, from whatever position you are in, just try and relay the information you have about the gospel to that person in a manner and in a way they can relate to. And that is very important. And that's a little bit, you know, what we are doing here with the Trent Analysis. All I'm doing is just talking about different ages, and it's my very subjective view of different decades, and you are entitled to have your own view, and I would encourage you to have your own view on this as well. But I want to get you thinking about different types of people, different generations, different decades, and to try and find out, you know, what these people are all about and what makes them tick and what makes them work and how to communicate with them. Okay, the two decades we're going to look at today are the noughties, you know, the 2000s and the 2010s. And everything is sort of been going into a certain direction. And when I say all this stuff, I'm pretty much looking at the Western development in the West, where we, you know, beginning of the century, so I'm talking about the 1900s, we had like 90%, you know, Christians. We believe in God. We believe in Jesus Christ. We may not be born again, or we may not fully understand what it's all about, but that is the premise we start from. That was pretty much in the 1900s. And you're looking at figures which go up to the 90 plus percent. And that is in America as well as in Europe as well. And today we are probably looking at less than 40%, maybe 30% of the population who still feel that God has got a relevance in their lives at all. And then even of those, many are just sort of nominal. They doesn't really mean anything. They probably couldn't fully explain the meaning of Christmas and Easter. And when you talk to them about Easter, you know, or they would understand that there's the Easter bunny and then there's Jesus, and they're not quite sure what it's all about. Okay, let's have a look at the different decades. And obviously we need to redress this. We need to reach out into a generation that has pretty much lost the plot, and that has come a long way in their on their path of apostasy from, you know, from their grandparents or great-grandparents knowing the Bible, having a good understanding of who God is, to a generation where God is just some love machine up there who will forgive everybody and is not to be feared. He's just the good, benevolent old guy in the sky. Yeah, this is pretty much the idea most people have. And so if you don't, you know, care about God all your life and you die, he'll still look after you because he's such a nice guy. And that is the deception that has crept in and that has been pushed upon this current generation. And it's shocking. It really is shocking. Okay, let's have a look. We've got the 2000s, so the years 2009. And one thing which I noticed was the nihilism. There was something, you know, where people don't know what they're here for anymore. Yeah, there was always this big look at the year 2000. And I sort of remember also as a kid, you know, what is life going to be like in the year 2000? And we were working out how old we were going to be in the year 2000. Then we had this story about the Millennium Book where we thought the world is going to come to an end. And you got plenty of crazy preachers who have come up proclaiming the return of Christ in the year 2000 or before or just after. And nothing really happened. Yeah. Technology hasn't really advanced that much as people thought it would. It started kicking in and it was there, but it all sort of really sort of broke out about 5 years later. Quite interesting, where there was suddenly this big boost in technology and, you know, other things were coming up. Internet speeds came up quite a lot in this, you know, later in 2000. We had a lot of nihilism and people just losing hope and truck, and they don't know what they're there for anymore. One thing I noticed is when I came to Britain in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a great sense of community. And there was something similar in Germany as well. People just stuck to one another. They had time for one another. I mean, obviously, there were always problems as well. But there was something there which was quite positive. And by 2000, all this was lost. There were just a bunch of individuals. People didn't, join together in communities anymore. Everything was defined by, and I think that I'm not sure whether it's the Thatcher's legacy. He and Margaret Thatcher, politician here in Britain, but I think there was something similar in throughout Europe, that everything was based around, is it profitable? Is it profitable? Does it bring jobs? Does it bring money? And so as a result of it, community centers were closed down, sort of educational avenues or libraries, they started being closed down. Public libraries, no more there. Public parks fell into neglect because they were not profitable. Yeah? And everything sort of was measured on how profitable it was going to be. When we look at Europe, the no-border regime came to an extreme. The euro was introduced, so the common currency. And that was an interesting thing as well. We had nobody in Germany, no person I spoke to in Germany, was in favor of the euro. They all wanted to keep the Deutschmark as a reliable, strong currency. The government never messed about with that because of the history of two big inflations. And nobody wanted the euro, but there wasn't a single political party who would stand up for election to say, we're going to keep the Deutschmark. If there had been one, I guarantee that that party would have been voted into parliament. And I thought it was quite interesting as far as democracy is concerned, where you look at the will of the people and the will of a small elite who feels that they need to decide on behalf of the people what's best for them. So the euro was introduced, yeah? Nobody wanted it, but it came whether you wanted it or not. I'm not quite sure what it was like in other countries, whether France, there was, within the population a similar sentiment that they wanted to keep their own currency and forget about the euro. But it was just imposed on people, and I think Britain was about inches away. Tony Blair tried his best to, from what I can gather from the politics, to try and get Britain into the euro, but there was probably too much resistance within the country, and he couldn't pull it off. What else? We had, I mentioned before, a colleague, he went against a gay advert and a notice board at the college where I worked. A colleague of mine, there was a gay advert, a manager, he saw this advert, gay advert, and he wanted this advert to be removed because he was offended by it. And they just went along with that and they removed it. And that was in the 90s, and that was okay in the 90s. And then suddenly in 2000, there was a lot of legislation which got outright protection for people with deviant sexual behavior, and under this protection they could enforce a law if somebody sort of started objecting to whatever they were doing. So, for example, in employment law, you had to employ them if they met certain criteria, and in my opinion, it's sort of a very, very strange change which took place within society in 2000, and partly driven maybe through nihilism and through a new moral code, which was somehow created by a liberal movement, by a liberal agenda. We had 2011 in the 2000s, and suddenly the whole Islamism thing came up and raised its head. Whether 2011 is a genuine thing or it's not a genuine thing, it changed life an awful lot. So we got a lot of legislation which puts a lot of control on a lot of people. Also, we had a rising, and I can sort of confirm this because I've been talking to Muslims who were involved with this and who knew people who got sucked into this whole movement, this whole radical movement. And so we had a rising of extreme radical Islamic expressions, and sort of a new, how shall I say, a new revival, you know, of radical extremist Islamism. And again, that's all happened in the 2000s. And I still remember when sort of in the 90s, I was talking to a lady. She was just a bank manager, and we just started talking, and she said that she really feared what is going on. Obviously, Islamization, and that's what she said in the 90s. And when sort of we look back a couple of decades, it's true. It's arrived. There are some very extreme radical tendencies. And I sort of still remember looking at some TV programs in Egypt where suddenly Egypt became more and more radical, where women decided to wear the veil. So if you went to Cairo, it used to look like just any Western city, and suddenly it changed. Yeah, you went to Cairo and it just looked like, you know, Saudi Arabia and the darkest medieval period. So very, very, very strange stuff was going on in the 2000s. And it seems communism was dead, and it had fallen, and the whole atheism thing didn't last, and they were just, you know, coming back up again. And as there was this vacuum of radical ideas, suddenly in this vacuum, Islam grew right into it, and we've still got it here today. And again, from a Christian perspective, what's been happening? You know, we have been sleeping, and we didn't really respond to the challenges which were brought to us by Islam for a long time. And on the contrary, we were just sort of trying to be nicey-nicey, and we get like crazy bishops in Sweden who decided, because they want to be nicey-nicey, to go into their church and to put an arrow pointing to Mecca so that Muslims who come to church can take their little carpet and worship Allah in the direction of Mecca. Sort of, is it the Qibla, which is called the direction for people to find out where they need to pray? And again, this is some madness we are dealing with. Why are these people doing this? Why are people facilitating in their church, which is built for the honor of Christ, to worship a God that says that Christ is not God, that he didn't die on the cross, and that, you know, that Christians need to be subjugated? Yeah, and if they don't pay the jizya, they need to be killed. Why should we pay homage to a god like that? And why should we facilitate worship for the adherents of this religion in our churches? I mean, they don't do this in their mosques. They are not putting in a cross. I mean, not that you worship a cross or anything like that, or just as a sign, you know, that Christians are welcome. Nothing like that. Okay. What else have we got in the 2000s? We've got a new definition of morality, and then we've got some other stuff as well. And in the 90s, we had the mega churches coming up. So we got like John Wimber and others who. So that's 80s and 90s. Who came up with this whole concept of mega church. I think the Crystal Palace was sometime in the 80s. And in the noughties, we get a different movement, and this movement is, I mean, it started before, but it sort of seemed to sort of grow really, really strong in the so-called seeker-friendly churches or emerging churches. And there are a lot of problems with that as well, where it's been recognized that there's a big problem in the church, and this is pretty much what I'm talking about as well, that people don't understand the message we have to proclaim anymore, because the world has fallen so far away from where the church is. And then obviously, I do understand this problem. That's what I'm talking about here as well, that we need to, you know, produce a message in a language that can be understood by the recipient. What they've done, though, is very often, and I think that is the big charge which is brought to the emerging church, and that is that they have diluted the gospel so far and brought the world into the church so much that it's very, very hard to find the gospel in the message that is delivered by these people. And we've got a big problem. in the church in that. That we have suddenly got something which is calling itself church. It tries to look like church, but the word of God is no longer in there. You know, they're preaching something else. And it in all intents and purposes, it is no longer church. So we have to look into this as well. I'm not quite sure. I've had a look at some of those examples, and I tried to sort of get my head around some of the emerging churches, some of the leaders within these emerging churches. And when I look at what these guys are piping up, it is very disconcerting. It's a big, big problem. They are preaching something else. They're no longer preaching the gospel. And we have to go right back to Galatians where Paul says, even if an angel of light came and preached to you a gospel different to the one I have preached to you, cursed be he. That's in Galatians, and that's what Paul is saying. And we are sort of coming close to this point where we have to say these guys are cursed because they are preaching a gospel that is no longer a gospel of repentance, a gospel of sin, a gospel of salvation from the wages of sin. But it's a different gospel they are preaching. There's no more repentance. It's a bloodless gospel, and it's not gospel at all. So again, we need to bear this in mind. And now we're coming to the 2010s, and we've got about 4 minutes left. We've got a decline of society and moral standards, and society is defunct. It's very dysfunctional at the moment when you go around. The divorce rates are so high, single parenthood, extremely high. We've got a wicked press who blatantly tells us lies. Integrity has gone out of the media. The media has been poised to degenerate society and to manipulate society. And they are open about it. They're even admitting to it. Go to the Hollywood industry and they're just telling you what they've been planning and intending for a long time. They celebrate the beast, you know, in all their little, award ceremonies where you get like these stars and some expressions of culture. And all it is just a celebration of evil. And they are not hiding it anymore. They are just plain out there in the open at the front, and people are just lapping it up. People are self-focused. There's an absence of trust in society, and I've never seen this like it is before. In the olden days, when I went to college, there was no real controls as such. And people weren't sort of doing stupid things either. Nowadays, everything is locked with cards. There are camera systems all over. You have to be checked all over the place before you can teach in a class. And I can understand why it's done and why it may be necessary. But it's such a change in society where nobody trusts anybody else anymore. And the assumption is always the worst. We've got something else as well, which I've never seen to that extent, which is an entitlement mentality, where people grow up and they believe they are entitled to stuff without doing anything for it. There's no more a sense of duty. If I go to my grandfather, he was just all about duty. Duty was number one in his life, and then the rest came afterwards. And that is what he was brought up with. And that was pretty much what was instilled in him when he was a kid. No, duty, you don't have duty anymore. You have just the rights, you know? And I find this sometimes with students, that students feel that it's my job and my responsibility that they learn. Yeah. And they can do what they want. They can mess about. They can run around. They can go crazy. I need to do it. It's my job. And if they don't get it, it's my fault. Yeah. It's not that, you know, they don't apply themselves. They don't see the need to apply themselves. And it's almost like a time bomb which we have created. We listened to the liberals. They told us how to bring up our kids, and you know anti-authoritarianism, and don't chastise them or anything like that. Let them do whatever they want. They need to learn, and so on. Yeah. That's what they have told us. And now we are ending up with generations. You know, a generation of this generation. And they haven't got a clue anymore. You know, they don't know what to do. They feel totally lost. They've got no direction in their life anymore. And all we have today is an absence of realism in the life of these people. And one day it's going to hit them, you know, that the world doesn't work like that. Yeah. They need to produce goods, listen when they need to listen, do when they're told to do something. And if they don't do this, they'll be out on their ears. Yeah, and they'll be impoverished one day. There's extreme political correctness, yeah. So it's almost a militancy within political correctness now. So if you step aside political correctness, there's a good chance that you'll be in trouble, you know, even to the point that you go to prison or lose your job. Yeah. So very often the PC dogma goes over and above victim protection. And that's something I've noticed as well in society, where people, you know, political correctness is most important. We had this in Germany where the immigrants came in. There was a rape mania going on in Cologne where I think the figure is about 600 or something. People came to the police and they said that they've been molested, some even raped, by immigrant gangs. Yeah. It wasn't done by Germans, wasn't done by native Germans, wasn't done by a mix of immigrants and Germans. It was just done by these gangs of immigrants who came to Cologne and just wanted to have a good time, and they haven't had a woman for a long time, so they just went all crazy, and it went out of control, it went out of hand. Okay, so that was what happened. Yeah? Now, the police didn't dare to say anything because they don't want it to be seen to be racist, yeah? Because that's against the PC theology, political correctness theology. You know, you can't do this. Yeah? You're a racist if you do this. And so then the whole thing just blew up and the media latched onto it. And then there was a big uproar. Why didn't the police report anything? Why did they say everything was fine? And then and the next year later, police had to pull the act together and they started, you know, addressing these groups who are likely to commit this crime from the year before. And now they were accused of doing racial profiling. And obviously some of them went around. They said no, they're not doing racial profiling. They're just looking who is likely to cause problems and who is doing problems and causing problems, and they just happen to be from one race. Yeah. That's what the answer was. But that is where suddenly the PC dogma is more important than the victims. There were people getting raped, and there were women being molested and being damaged for maybe the rest of their lives. And that didn't count. The most important thing was to be politically correct and not to be seen to be a racist or to do any racial profiling or to do any ethnic profiling and so on. Be it right or not, but there's something which is called common sense. And my thinking is it should be applied in any concept. And it's very important to protect those who are likely to be victimized as well. And they are probably more important than the offender, or the rights of the offender are the rights of the victims, should be more important, but that doesn't fit into PC theology anymore. Okay, so what are we looking at in the 2010s? We've got almost a total destruction of the family in the West. We've got a new poverty. People are not being able to feed themselves because of various levers that has been introduced. And because the family is being broken down, there are no longer traditional safety nets for people to survive. So that was a trend analysis. We need to understand what is going on in society. And I hope that this has been helpful to you for your war room exercises. Look at your generation and look at the people you are dealing with. Do some analysis. Pray about them. And then get the gospel ready to move into this situation. God bless and bye-bye from Michael in the War Room.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Schonborn. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to ChristianWarRoom.com. That's ChristianWarRoom.com.